Where warp meets weft. Where warp meets weft. This is Weavecast with Sine Mitchell.
Hello and welcome. I'm Sine Mitchell and this is Weavecast. This year for Halloween, I've disguised myself as Eric Nyland, talented science fiction writer. What do you think? Here, let me say something guy-like. Hey, how about that local sports team? And babe, can you bring me another beer? What? The toilet seat's always been up like that. Pretty convincing, huh? Trick or treat. Okay, the reality is I am Eric Nyland, Sine's husband. She's a bit mumbly post-surgery, and while she has pre-recorded much of this episode, there are inevitably some last-minute things that needed to be recorded, and that's where I come in. When you hear me talk, know that it's Sine speaking, and if you ask me, she's looking way too happy about being able to put words in my mouth. And by the way, have I mentioned how incredibly beautiful Sine is, and how glad I am that she took up weaving and brought all this wonderful fiber and all those great looms into our house?
Welcome to episode 20, Scottish Weaving. This episode, we explore the rich weaving traditions of Scotland. We're going to hear the amazing story of the Kilbarkan Project, which was an effort to save previously undiscovered historical Scottish weaves. We're going to talk with wonderful weavers Barbara Miller and Marjorie Warren, and I'll describe learning to weave tweeds and tartans at the John C. Campbell Folk School.
And now, for all you surgical survivors out there, the official post-operative theme song.
Give me that old-fashioned morphine. Give me that old-fashioned morphine. Give me that old-fashioned morphine. That's good enough for me.
A big thank you to Nicole in Wisconsin for sending me that song as an iTunes gift. It gave me a much-needed smile. And to Tommy, who sent me some gorgeous spinning fiber. You're absolutely right. Alpaca is way better than flowers.
That's good enough for me.
I've had my surgery and am recovering. I'm indulging in a lot of gentle weaving. Thank you, everyone who asked how I was doing or sent me a comment. Your well wishes meant the world to me.
Go away because the world is almost done.
A quick correction. In episode 17, I mistakenly associated Twist with Braider's Hand. My apologies. Twist is the newsletter for the Tablet Weavers International Studies and Techniques organization and is written by its members. Braider's Hand is a business that sells kumihimo and braiding equipment. Sorry for any confusion. The Spokane Hand Weavers Guild asked me to mention that they are now accepting proposals for seminars and workshops for the 2009 ANWIG conference. If you are interested in teaching or presenting, please send your proposals to Victoria Luba, VLEUBA, at comcast.net. A reminder about the upcoming fundraising auction in November. Since last episode, a whole host of new things have come in. Several listeners surprised me with their generosity and donated items they'd woven or goodies from their stash. That was completely unanticipated. Thank you.
The auction will run from November 9th to November 16th. I will ship items the very next day, so you will get them in plenty of time for winter holidays. I'm using eBay to handle the auction mechanics. It's the world's most reliable online auction software, and it's completely free to users who register and bid on items. I'd like to thank everyone who responded to last month's survey. I take that feedback very seriously and am factoring it into my plans for some exciting new things in the online weaving world. More about that in future episodes. If you haven't responded yet to the survey, there's still time to fill it out and enter the drawing for the painted warp. Let me know what you'd like to see happen in the future of Weavecast, even if your response is, don't change a thing.
If you're curious about what other listeners think about Weavecast, there will be a link on the show notes to the survey results.
Our sponsor this episode is Just Our Yarn, purveyors of luxurious hand-painted yarns, Tencel, Silk, Merino, Angora, Cashmere. They also provide quick start weaving kits to get you up and warped and weaving as fast as possible. We appreciate their continued support. You can check out their wares at www.justouryarn.com.
I've currently got their Caravan Scarf Kit on the warping board. The draft they included is interesting. I think you'd call it a broken twill. The yarn is luscious. 65% wool, 35% camel down dyed in a series of jewel tones. The project says to wind a 3-yard warp, 8.5 inches wide. I kept going and eked out a bit over 10 inches wide. The kit includes another painted skein to use as weft, but I'm not sure I'm going to follow the directions, or substitute a solid color weft and make 2 scarves. I think a black silk weft would make the colors really pop, and the shiny would look great against the matte. I'll sample both options and post the results on my blog, Weavecast, Backstage.
I'm here at the John C. Campbell Folk School with Marjorie Logie Warren. She is teaching cooking this week, but she's also a very fine weaver and designs tartans. So welcome.
Thank you, Sine. Glad to be here.
Can you tell us a little bit about where you're from?
I'm from Cambuslang, Glasgow, Scotland. I immigrated to America in 1963. I've been here for a long time, but there's not a year gone by that I haven't had family or friends or have gone backwards and forwards. I'm also connected with a weaving mill in Scotland called Loch Carron.
So when did you first learn to weave?
My husband was on sabbatical at Lake Junaluska, North Carolina. I got a leave of absence from my work and I didn't know what to do with myself. I knew a lady who was head of continuing education in Canton, North Carolina. And she told me, would I like to come and weave? And I thought, well, that would take up my time, yes. So I went to the continuing education class while my husband was writing a book, and my whole world changed. It was the most expensive sabbatical we've ever been on. We came home with a truck and a loom and all kinds of equipment. Then when we left Nashville, Tennessee in 1989, my life again took a change because I went back to school to Haywood Community College that has a production crafts program which includes weaving, pottery, fine woodwork, and metal. It was a 2-year course, and my instructor is Catherine Ellis. During that time, we had to choose an area of interest in weaving to pursue. I chose the field of tartan weaving. We were doing twills as part of our weaving education. Catherine did a small section on tartan weaving, and there it was. Tartan is an art form. As the colors cross the web, they are combined and they change, and you get lovely combination of colors, not just stripes horizontally and vertically. And it's a very precise form of weaving. It's very demanding, takes a lot of practice, and I like the discipline. The following summer, I happened to be at Grandfather Mountain Highland Games, and one of the clans, the Mingus clan, asked me to bring my loom and do some demonstration. So I thought, well, I'll have a go, and I took up my small loom and put on a piece of, I think it was probably the Mingus tartan, and I wove, and so many people came up and were so interested in what I did, and I got my first commission, I'll never forget it, to weave a scarf. And that got me going, and I came back to school, and I was so excited, and from there it just took off. When I graduated, we had to have pieces of work for the graduate show, and I found that I loved weaving this fabric in many different forms, not just heavy wool. You can do it in lots of fine silk, cotton, all kinds of things, and it just looks absolutely beautiful. So I diversified and used all of these different yarns, which made it very interesting. 3252 cotton is a wonderful way to start, and I don't know if you know that you can do beautiful tartan weaving with a 3-2 in plain weave. My blankets are all done in plain weave, and they're gorgeous.
Interesting. Why did you choose plain weave instead of twill?
Because of the size of the yarn, the blankets are 3/2, which is heavier. Now, the napkins that I do, I use a 5/2, and that's still done in plain weave. My favorite is weaving in fine silk.
Now, when you say fine silk, how fine are you?
62s. And I am the only person who puts gold thread in the fine dance sashes. And that was back in the Victoria times. They had shot gold in the taffeta, and I chose to substitute some of the threads, and in the place I put gold. And when ladies are doing Scottish country dancing, the light picks up the gold. It's just absolutely beautiful. I call them contemporary heirlooms.
Oh, they sound beautiful. When you adapt a tartan pattern to, say, 60s over 2 fine silk, do you have to adjust the numbers of threads?
Yes, you do. The rule of thumb is everything is done in even numbers. Odd numbers really don't work. You really don't want to work with less than 2 threads because it looks like salt and pepper, 1 thread weaving. It's all done to proportion, and that's trial and error, and I had to work all that out. Obviously, if you were doing a kilt fabric, the size would be different from a fine silk because of the weight of the yarn.
You have designed a Celtic woman's tartan. Can you tell me how that project came about?
There is a group in this country called Celtic Women International. It started in Milwaukee about 10 years ago. It's for women. If you belong to any of the 7 Celtic nations, Scotland, Wales, Ireland, Isle of Man, Cornwall, Brittany, and Galicia, through marriage or through your own background, we would encourage you to join. There's a website, there's newsletters.
So how did you come to be asked to design the tartan?
The conference, we invite people from all these different nations to come and give papers, to sing, to dance. I was asked to come up and talk about tartans. We were gathering and I had this wild hair. I said, wouldn't it be wonderful to have our own tartan? President Jean Bill said, well, tell me more about it. And I said, well, you know, there is no tartan for women.
You mean traditionally all the tartans belong to the men?
Clans, or it was kind of a man thing. So it sounded like a wonderful project. And what I did to design this, the background for Celtic Women International was beautiful purple and black, almost a fuchsia. That was our logo. So I used that as a background, and on that I laid the 7 flags of the Celtic nations. I laid them all out side by side. Some of the flags had the same colors, and I laid that on the purple and black to get there's green in it and red and a lovely blue. And so I combined that, laid it on top, and it worked. I think there's 6 colors in this design. I thought it was very feminine but strong. Anybody can design a tartan, and there's more than 3,500 tartans registered in the world. And more are being designed and registered all the time. It's absolutely amazing. Because it means belonging. It could be corporate.
I saw a Harley Davidson tartan.
Harley Davidson, yes. There's even a Donald Duck. So there is corporate, there is clan tartans. Some new ones have been designed for various clans that have come on the scene. And then there's individuals for families, a family tartan. There are district tartans, which is like a county.
What goes into developing a new tartan?
You have to come up with a design. And then you send it to the Scottish Tartan Authority. And it's checked against the Syndex to get a clear and free, quote, title. When it passes, then you have a design. And you get a certificate saying that Celtic Women International is a registered tartan, etc. It's very lovely. They do a lovely job. Cost about $250 to have it. You can register it without having the certificate, but most people like to have a certificate that they can hang in their office or home or whatever, and with a seal of approval from the Lord Lion. It's not terribly complicated.
Now, is that also an organization that you could use to look up your family tartan?
Absolutely. I would encourage those people who are listening to this podcast to go into www.scottishtartansauthority.com.
What distinguishes Scottish weaving from other types?
The way I look at it is there are several different distinct patterns. Obviously, the tartan. The other cloth, I also think, is very synonymous to Scotland. Estate tweeds or district checks. It's a colour and weave effect, and it looks like you've been terribly clever, but it's very simple. The estate checks were for the large estates in Scotland. Again, a belonging, the workers on the estate would wear the actual cloth of the estate, and that's why they were called estate checks. That cloth is very subdued. It's not bright like the tartans, and that's because the workers on the estate, when they went out deer hunting, etc., etc., they could blend into the countryside.
Oh, so it was an early form of camouflage.
Yes. Then the other distinct cloth is Harris tweed. It's been around for a long time. I remember my mother saying to my father, who had a Harris tweed jacket, "Well, we'll be able to lay you out in it, Jimmy. It'll last a lifetime." Which is true. It is woven on the island of Harris. And there is a special orb or name that goes on that cloth. It is also a very subdued colors, but it does capture the actual colors of Harris, the lichens and the sea. One thing I have to say about Harris tweed, there's a terribly interesting chap up in Luskintyre called John Mackay, and he's a marvelous Harris tweed weaver. The Nike company knocked on his door and they said, "Could you weave so many thousands of yards for us? We want to make exclusive training shoes with Harris tweed on them." And John Mackay said, "Oh, that won't be any trouble at all." He got all the local weavers in their weaving sheds to help him weave.
So there's a Nike tennis shoe, yeah, with real Harris tweed, or
yeah, with real Harris tweed on it.
Oh, how wonderful.
And we saw the shoe and talked to John, and
was it a good looking shoe?
Oh, it was great. I never saw it in the market. I think it was such high end, it went to, I don't know who it went to, but it caused such a buzz, and it put Harris tweed up front, and the people realized that it wasn't just heavy Harris tweed, but it was woven in many, many ways.
Now, I have to ask this because I've just taken a class on tartan weaving, and I read your notes on tartan weaving from when you taught the class, mm-hmm, and you were saying it must be a 45-degree angle, and the number of picks weft-wise have to be the number of threads, and no cheating and adding extra threads. So what's the secret of weaving a perfect tartan?
Practice.
I knew you were going to say that. Thank you so much for sitting down and talking to me in the middle of your busy teaching week. As we head off, what's next for you?
I'm heading up to New York at the end of this month. I'm going to be doing a lecture for the Manhattan Weaving Guild at the Visual Arts Center, and I'm looking forward to it tremendously. I'm going to be giving a lecture on tartan and beyond, the method to the madness. It's sharing. It's just sharing the love of what I do. I want to keep the hand-weaving tartan alive. There's just nobody left in Scotland. My great mentor and teacher, Peter MacDonald, had to give it up and really earn a living. It's very hard. I think there's just nothing more wonderful than sitting at a hand loom and producing these beautiful pieces of cloth.
Barbara Miller has been weaving for more than 40 years and is renowned for her knowledge of historical overshot patterns, especially as relates to Appalachian hand weaving.
I had been wanting to learn to weave for years and had never found anyone that lived in my immediate area that's teaching weaving. I was a member of the Southern Highland Craft Guild. At one of our meetings, I met a woman who was looking at the crafts on display with me, and she was criticizing the weaving. I was standing there looking at her when she said, "Well, I'm a weaving teacher, and I wouldn't let my students get away with this." First weaving teacher I'd ever met. The bells and whistles went off, and I immediately started asking questions about, could she take me on as a student? she said, right now, because I don't have room in my class. The studio is very small. Several months later, she came by my house one afternoon and she said, one of my ladies is going to have surgery this summer. Would you like to take her play while she's out? Since I was working for the school system, I was going to be off in the summertime. And I said, sure, I'd like to do that. She said, now I'm going to teach you how to thread the loom and how to read a pattern. And the rest of it, you have to learn yourself. Most of it was done with 3-2 and 5-2 purl cotton. And Alice had told me that I needed to put it on at 24 ends to the inch. She didn't explain to me what 24 ends to the inch was, so one of the ladies said, well, you're going to wind 24 threads for each inch of your warp, and whatever you're going to make, you measure that, and then you multiply. So I had this real heavy warp, and I got it threaded through the reed, and somebody showed me how to thread the harness, and I got that on, got it tied onto the back beam, and started trying to wind it through the reed. Well, it wouldn't come. And Alice come by, and she says, well, what in the world have you got so much thread on there for? That's too much. And I said, well, that's what you told me to do. So she helped me get it on the loom, and then we couldn't break the shed. So my first weaving project was rep, whether I wanted it to be rep or not. Every time I tried to raise the harnesses, I had to raise them by hand. I did get through the first weaving project. I made placemats. I'm still using those placemats as potholders today. They had a wonderful library there that some weaver had presented to the weaving group. So I just started devouring every bit of material that I could get a hold of, and borrowing books and magazines and things and reading. The summer went on and the lady that was weaving came back and it was time for school to start. I didn't want to quit. I wasn't going to quit. I was going to do it somehow. I'd even made up my mind if I had to quit my job, I was going to do that. I talked to my principal and we worked out a deal.
What do you think there is about weaving that made you, you know, after one summer, willing to quit your job?
I have no idea. I don't know till today what is the fascination with it. It's the interlacement of the threads. It is knowing that you are creating something new, yet you are doing something that is so old. When I am weaving, I am walking in tandem with all the weavers that have gone before. The Folk School was one of the founding members of the Southern Highland Craft Guild. Throughout the years of being in the guild and doing their fairs, I had gotten acquainted with all of the people that were here at the Folk School. They asked me if I would be interested in teaching a class. That started me coming every year.
What is Scottish Heritage Week?
The program director that was here several years ago had the idea of having special theme weeks. The first one that they had was Shaker Week. It was all things Shaker. It was a very well-received and well-attended week, and it was always held in November. From that, other theme weeks began to be developed. In 2003, we had an exhibit at the Folk Arts Center that was on Scotland and Scottish crafts. And it was an international exhibit and had quite a large following. In preparing for that, Marge Warren prevailed upon them for the Folk School to continue with that theme. And the people that were coming to Asheville to see that exhibit come on to the Folk School for Scottish Heritage. So Scottish Heritage Week was added. Different presenters or teachers are here every year, so it's not the same old, same old. And they have different music performers, different teachers, different crafts being taught. So you could come every year for Scottish Heritage Week and experience something different.
You've been teaching for quite a while. What advice would you give beginning weavers?
The same advice that was given to me whenever I started. Never forget your selvages. Probably the greatest discovery that I ever made was what was tabby. I had been weaving. Alice, bless her dear heart, she really let me learn on my own. I had been weaving, and I was weaving plain weave. So she said I should try some pattern weaving. So she helped me put on an overshot warp. I was working in the room with all these other weavers, and one of the ladies that was weaving next to me said, now, Barbara, you know you have to use tabby with that. And I was so green and so nervous and so scared that I did not dare ask what it was. I just was trying to watch them to see what they was doing. Well, they were throwing a pattern shot, and then they was doing plain weave. I didn't see no tabby anywhere. So I take Mary Black's book home, New Key to Weaving, and Mary Atwater's book, and I read every word in Mary Black's book. Nowhere does she tell you what tabby is. She tells you to use it, but does she tell you that tabby is plain weave? No. Does Mary Atwater? No. Nobody tells you what tabby is. So the first thing I do with my beginning students, I tell them tabby and plain weave are one and the same.
So what are your plans for the future?
I am getting rid of my AVL loom. I'm downsizing. I plan to weave more yardage. I probably will never weave another coverlet. At my age, I'm still buying yarn. My dear Alice, the day before she died, she went to the yarn store and came home with a carload of yarn. And she was well equipped. And so I plan to go out the same way.
Marjorie Warren and Barbara Miller were the right weavers in the right place when they stumbled across unsuspected treasures at the Weaver's Cottage in Kilbarkin, Scotland.
Can you tell me about the Kilbarkin Project?
The Kilbarkin Project grew out of another love of mine. I have been researching overshot Appalachian weaving for a number of years. In looking at the old drafts that the Appalachian weavers had used, so many of them were marked, came from Scotland, came from Ireland. I wanted to find what the connection was between Scotland and Western North Carolina. Did that thread still exist? Marge does textile tours of Scotland every 2 years.
I lead textile tours called Tracing Our Threads. For the last 15 years, I've been doing this with another colleague called Rory McLeod. He's been president of Scotland's Island Experiences. And Barbara was on one of my tours.
I went with her on one of her tours in 97, looking for overshot patterns in Scotland. At the end of that tour, we went to visit the Weaver's Cottage in Kilbarkin.
Kilbarkin was a weaving village right outside of Glasgow, 10 minutes from the Glasgow airport. Kilbarkin was very much a part of that, quote, cottage industry. At one time, there were over 400 weavers in this village, and as she went down the street, you'd hear the clack of the looms. This cottage belonged to the Christie sisters, and in 1953 it was used as a weaver's cottage, and when they died, they turned it over to the National Trust of Scotland. So they recreated a cottage like it would be before the Industrial Revolution. So we went to Kilbarkin, and Chrissy McLeod, who is the manager there, greeted us warmly. She knew me, of course. And I was taking Alison, my cousin's wife, out into the garden to look at the natural plants and the bees, the beekeeping and everything. And Barbara was sitting inside looking just at the cottage and some of the weaving.
The weaver's cottage was where the last remaining weaver lived in Kilbarkin. It was built in the 1700s. A stone house, just like everything else in the village, was built out of stone. And it was at that time used by two families. The weaver's family lived on one side and another tradesman lived on the other side, and a long hallway that went all the way through the house and out into the garden. The rooms were very small and stone floors. The floor of the weaving room, the loom was set down into a pit so that when the weaver sat down, he was almost level with the rest of the floor and his feet were low. And it was dirt underneath. The loom is a counterbalance with horses instead of rollers. And I did my little bit of asking the curator, did she have any old weaving drafts? And she said, we do. And so she brought me two little weaving books with weaving drafts in them. And I realized that this was not a draft book. This was the journal book that the cottage weaver had kept of everything that he had woven. Every page was covered with the tie-up, the record of the material, what it was called, how much yarn he had used, also how much he had gotten paid for it. Wow. And the date that he had woven it. We only had just a few minutes to work, so I copied a couple of the drafts.
Barbara was just sitting there, and she brought out these books out of the cupboard that had just been chucked in there. And she opened the book, and her eyeballs almost fell out because she saw treasures there that she had never seen before. Barbara, being such an astute woman and a real expert in 18th century patterns, quickly wrote down three patterns. Thanked the lady, gave her back the book, and she said, "You won't believe what I found in there." So she was excited, and then
came home, and in compiling all my other stuff, I put these on the computer and realized that I hadn't seen this fabric before. It was a twill, so I wove samples of it and sent them to various people who I knew would be interested in it.
Barbara wove up, I believe, in just cotton three of the patterns, found out that there was something very exciting in these books, and nothing else was really done about it. One of the ladies on our textile tour, we call her our fairy godmother, a lady with a great deal of means, very anonymous and very generous. She was the patron of the arts, shall we say. And I was talking to her. She lived in Birmingham. I was telling her about what we discovered. She said, "Well, are you going to do anything about it?" And I said, "Well, not really." She said, "Well, why don't you get a grant and go over there and copy them down and get some more information?" And she said, "I'll start you off." And she gave us a lovely amount of money to get going. Barbara was living in Florida at the time. She goes down in the winter. And I called her and I said, "Are you standing or sitting?" And she said, "Well, whatever you want me to do." And I said, "Barbara, we're going to do the Kilbarkin Project."
What was her reaction?
Oh, she almost collapsed. Barbara, in her very thoughtful way, said, "Oh, yes, we can do this." I became the project manager. Barbara was the expert in the actual weaving and the patterns, although I very quickly learned how to do this with her guidance. Then I wrote grants, and we got a wonderful grant from a Scottish Heritage USA, which is part of the National Trust of Scotland. I got another grant from Southern Highland Craft Guild, so the money started coming in.
It all came together. You know how, if it's meant to be, it will be. So we found ourselves back at Kilbarkin.
We made arrangements, got in touch with National Trust, got in touch with, at that time, there was another lady who was project manager, but Chrissy McLeod, who is now there, was very much a part of it. And then I called my cousin, who lived 20 minutes away on the other side of Kilbarkin, in a town called Kilmacomb. And I told him what we were thinking of doing, and I said, "Could Barbara and I come and stay for a month?" He said, delighted. He was retired, had a whole office at our disposal, copying machines, and he was an amazing photographer. That's how it started. The following year, everything was in place, and two little old ladies took their laptops and went off to Scotland.
So we found ourselves back at Kilbarkin. The curator brought this material that we had asked for out to us in the garden. She had prepared tea, and she looked very puzzled, and she said, "I only have a 4x4 foot office, and there's nowhere for you to work."
He said, "Oh no, just take it off to your cousins, it doesn't matter." And we said, "Well, we'll bring the books back every weekend." Oh, they said, "Oh, don't bother about that, you know, just as long as you need them, we know where they are."
"Which ones do you want?" And she had brought seven. I quickly looked through them, and the one that looked like it had the most information in it was about 4 inches wide, about 5 inches high. It was a very small little book. When you turn the pages, the paper just disintegrated around it. It was so fragile. The earliest date in it was 1840. The latest date was 60-something. I said, "Well, I'd like to work with this one." And there were a couple of other books that were around the late 1800s, early 1900s, and Marge said, "Well, I'll take one of these." And she said, "Well, you can take them all if you want to." And we said, "No, no, 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 we don't want to be responsible for them." She said, "But I have one question to ask you. Why did you choose this little museum to do this?" And I said, "Well, I was here 2 years ago, and you showed me the books." And she looked at me with a funny look on her face. She said, "I have never showed those books to but one person." I said, "I'm back." We opened our laptops and we worked I, having worked with the old Appalachian drafts, I can read an old draft real fast, which was a good thing, because within 3 weeks' time, I put 1,100 drafts in my computer.
I was working in another book of a student that went to a technical college. It was a little further on in time, and he did a two-year course there, more into the Jacquard looms. Exquisitely done, with beautiful writing and penmanship and beautiful illustrations of what he was doing with woven samples in the book. Towards the end of the month, when we were getting to the end of it, my cousin took my book out into the garden where the light was beautiful, and we have rigged up this whole contraption to photograph it. And he did all the photography for us, anything we wanted, the outside covers of the books. And before we left to come back to America, USA, all the photography was done.
In writing our grant, we had to mount an exhibit of what we had done. So we came home, I wore out a printer, printing those drafts so that we could start deciding what we were going to do for the exhibit. Marge worked on getting the yarn for the exhibit.
When I was in Scotland, one of the places we went to visit was Johnson's of Elgin, a big weaving mill. They had the colors that we were looking for.
We had Cambridge and Oxford blue. There was black, two shades of brown, a red and a yellow, a mossy green, and then dark green.
And I called up the head designer who I'd met, and I said, how would you like to be involved in this project? And Johnson's of Elgin gave us free 42 kilos of yarn.
We went to our Western North Carolina Fiber Hand Weavers Guild and said, okay, girls, it's time for you to step up now. We're going to have an exhibit at the Folk Art Center next spring. We want each one of you to weave 36 inches of wool fabric using these drafts, and we'll provide the wool. We had 93 weavers.
From Scotland, from all over the United States, but mainly our guild, the Western North Carolina Western Fiber Guild. We put together packets of yarn and the instructions. We have winter project in our guild, and we're out for 2 months, mainly because of bad weather, and that was the winter project, along with other people who were doing it.
One of the weavers said that she didn't like the colors that we were using, and we had a guild member who grew up in England. And she said, I'll have you know that those are the colors that you would have worn if you'd lived there when everybody was burning coal, because there was so much dirt, you would not wear black colors.
We had these wonderful 3-yard lengths of fabric woven.
And we chose, out of those 93, the best weave structures, the best consensus of what we had done and what was in the books. And then we were able to borrow from Kilbarkin some copies of photographs. So we brought a little piece of the weaver's cottage at Kilbarkin to Asheville.
We had the opening, and the first day we had 3,500 people that came to view the weaving. It was up all summer, and we had people coming in to demonstrate on a loom.
They had a sample piece hanging on the wall, and then there was a touch-feel piece, and the draft, and the drawdown, and treadling and everything.
We had the weavers' names on the boards. It was very successful.
One of the stipulations in getting our grant was that we had to present a catalog with the exhibit. That catalog is in the form of a draft book. It has the story of the project and all of the drafts that were in the exhibit.
You and Barbara published a monograph.
It's in black and white because of cost. We picked several patterns.
So you picked the top patterns of the Kilbarkin project.
We put it into the booklet with instructions how to weave it. It was on sale. I have the books. My business is called Thistle Studio, 350 Crum Drive, C-R-U-M Drive, Lake Junaluska, J-U-N-A-L-U-S-K-A, North Carolina, 28745. And my email is numeral1, mwarren@bellsouth.net. My phone number is 828-452-0782.
So if people are interested in getting a copy of the monograph, they can just contact you directly.
Yeah, definitely. Great.
And now, a delightfully untraditional Scottish ballad.
came down to the river Tay from the Elands. Tuesday found his way to America. Great-great-grandpa Wallace, Grandpa Wallace, he did say, gonna be a cowboy one fine day. Whenever you get saddled, I'm sure that you'll be rattled by great-great-grandpa Wallace. Why I'm here, not over there, is why I'm riding this big black mare. And guns and kilt, you better not stare. Canadian Celtic cowboy, Canadian Celtic cowboy, yeehaw. Now he got along well with one of the boys, but wasn't he dressing that way? We did skirt, he did sashay, my great-great-grandpa Wallace. Billy the Kid taught to draw, when he heard a laugh for a loud guffaw, to be a funeral next day, fighting would play, paid by Marshall Wallace. So why I'm over here, not over there, while I'm riding this big black mare, and guns and kilt, you better not stare at the Canadian Celtic cowboy. Canadian Celtic cowboy, now we can ride into town, we'd be singing that famous song that we wrote that goes, yippee-ki-yay, 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 sounds good, eh? Strutting past Rosalie's, and the sound of a harp on a good stiff breeze. Great great grandpa got on his knees and married Angel Wannis. Traveled out west to find a home, settled in a town called Tombstone, started a choir for gunslingers. Most of them were singers, Church of Reverend Wallace. Why I'm here, not over there, is why I'm not wearing my underwear. What did I say that for? That's why I'm here, not over there, is why I'm riding this big black mare. And guns and kilt, you better not stare at the Canadian Celtic cowboy. That's better. Canadian Celtic cowboy. No, you went by without a fight. A gunman arrived, puts quite a sight. A rival clan, a Celtic knight, challenged Grandpa Wallace. Lucky for me that his son was born, cause the showdown came that very morn. When he went for his gun, he grabbed his spawn as the end of Grandpa Wallace. Why I'm here, not over there, is why I'm riding this big black mare. And guns and kilt, you better not stare at the Canadian Celtic cowboy. Canadian Celtic cowboy. Now Grandpa Wallace, you could say, became a legend in his day. From the great white north, they still ride forth, Canadian Celtic cowboys. They be singing that famous song, yes, they wrote, that goes, yippee-ki-yay, yippee-ki-yay.
In today's audio essay, I talk about my experiences learning Scottish weaving at the John C. Campbell Folk School. I was invited to come take a workshop at the John C. Campbell Folk School, and I'd been curious. I'd seen their ads in places like Handwoven and Shuttle Spindle and Dye Pot, so I jumped at the chance. The week that worked out for my schedule turned out to be Scottish Heritage Week, a subject that I was kinda lukewarm about. But hey, I love learning new things, so why not? What surprised me most about the workshop was how delightful the Scottish weaves were. I had always looked at tartans as glorified plain weave. Now, I like plain weave, but tartans look like plain weave made fiddly with a lot of color changes. And I don't really have a strong attraction to plaids, but tartans did win me over during the course of this workshop. One thing that helped was the instructor had picked the clan tartans that we were going to weave before she got the class list. So just by pure dumb luck, one of the clans she chose was Mitchell. And of course, me being Sign Mitchell, she gave me that one to warp up. And something happened as I started to put the colors on the loom. I would look at it and I'd think, that's my name. That's the pattern woven and used by people related to me. And it also helped that the colors were green and blue and black with just a little bit of red and white. So they weren't like, you know, the orange and puce. I might not have been excited about weaving my name if it was orange and puce. But they were lovely, lovely colors. And there will be a picture of it up in the show notes if you want to see what the Mitchell tartan looks like. So I started weaving, and I hadn't realized that you weave a tartan in 2-2 twill. And I did several of the tartan samples in both plain weave and the 2-2 twill. And weaving it in twill makes a big difference. When you weave a tartan in plain weave, what happens is the colors blend. Depending on the color choices, they can get muddy. So when I wove the Mitchell tartan in plain weave, I didn't like it so much. The colors blended and it was kind of a subtle shading. When I rewove the tartan in the tutu twill, the colors blended in a diagonal. It broke up the rectilineal of the plaid by adding this diagonal tutu twill element. And the other thing is, instead of muddying the colors together like with plain weave, the tutu twill caused the colors to almost have a shadow weave effect, because you'd have a line of green and then a line of blue and a line of green and a line of blue. So the colors were still mixing, but it wasn't an optical mixing. It had lines of color blending together instead of pixels of color. And it was just lovely. Barbara Miller, who was teaching the class, has done a lot of research into Scottish history and Scottish weaving. She seems to specialize in historical weaves. She's done a lot of research on coverlets, especially those from the Appalachian region. And she talked a lot about the history. And one thing I had not known is, in addition to the tartans, there were other weave structures that designated who you were and who you worked for. When the English came over to Scotland and started building manor estates, each estate would have its own tweed, its own set of checks or herringbone that identified you as associated with that estate. So if you were a groundsman, you would wear that estate's tweed. If you were a maid, you would wear, as part of your uniform, that estate's tweed. So when you went out in the village, they knew which manor house you were associated with. Another thing I didn't realize is that some of the tweeds with the kind of melding colors and blending of colors were actually camouflage. The muddy colors and the shifting patterns helped huntsmen hide. Very interesting stuff. I think of camouflage, I think of the army patterns. I didn't realize that weavers back in the 1700s, back in the 1800s, were producing camouflage using these tweedy yarns. We heard Marjorie and Barbara talk earlier about the Kilbarkin Project, and as one of the samples that she had us weave, actually there were two samples. There was a 4-shaft version and an 8-shaft version. But the way the weaver at Kilbarkin worked was that you had a plain draw set up on your loom. So if you had 4 shafts, it was set up 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2, 3, 4. If you had an 8-shaft loom, it was set up 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, but straight draw. And you'd put a long, long warp on it, because what you would do is to create different twills by varying the tie up. And so what Barbara had us do in class is she said, okay, here are 40 to 60 weaves from the Kilbarkin Project. And these have been collected into a monograph published by Barbara and Marjorie called The Kilbarkin Project. It's a wonderful book. Everybody, I think, in the class bought one. It's got all these historical weaves. But what she had us do was look at the weaves in this monograph, pick a couple that we liked, and then go over to the loom that everybody was going to weave on, change the tie-up, and weave our twill. So with one warp, you could weave any of these 40 to 60 twills. And that really opened my mind. And it made me think, yes, if you were a production weaver, you would want to work like that. You'd want to be able to put on a really long warp and then get a myriad of different types of textiles out of it. And it was interesting because some of the textiles had strong diagonal focus. Some of them were undulating twills. Some of them were checks. And it all came from the same single color warp with a different color weft. The variety was just amazing. I really liked the intellectual rigor of that, and I'm going to try to figure out how to apply that rationale to future weaving, because it would be fun to put on a long warp and then weave for a long time and create a variety of things. We wove several tartans. We wove several checks and estate checks. We wove herringbone in the tweeds that created the camouflage pattern. We wove several twills of our choosing from the Kilbarkin Project. And we wove a tartan in a non-traditional pattern, in a twill other than tutu twill, and the results were just stunning. This is something that the weaver at Kilbarkin had said, oh, it's too hard, you can't do this. And Barbara Miller, being the person she was, decided to figure out how to take that other twill structure and impose it onto the tartan. And the results were stunning. In closing, I started off being kind of lukewarm about Scottish textiles, and I came away from it impassioned about Scottish textiles. When I talked to Russell Groff way back in the Black Sheep Gathering episode, he said his favorite thing to weave was tartans. And at the time, I did not understand why. But I get it now. They're really cool, both from the historical and the color aspect. I'm definitely going to do some more. That's all for this episode. So until next time, it's time to get warped, because everyone knows you have to be warped to weave.
Our musical guests this episode were Tiger Tail playing Celtic Mystic, Celtic Stone with their song Drowsy Maggie, the Canadian Celtic Cowboy performing his song Canadian Celtic Cowboy, and Old Fashioned Morphine, written and performed by Jolie Holland. Ms. Holland's music was played with permission from her agent. The rest of these artists generously shared their talents on the PodSafe Music Network. Weavecast is supported by its donating listeners. This episode I'd like to thank Gina, Kristen, Jan, Yuriko, Zoe, Angela, and Jean.
Our sponsor this episode is Just Our Yarn. We appreciate their continued support. You can check out their wares at www.justouryarn.com. Grant funding for Weavecast comes from the Hand Weavers Guild of America and the Seattle Weavers Guild. Thank you for helping make Weavecast possible.
Trick or treat! Here are a few terrifying outtakes. And you know, I really want you to know how difficult it is for a guy to say lines like, "The yarn is luscious," in a series of jewel tones. I'm probably going to burn in man hell.
Hello, this is Sign Mitchell of Weavecast, and this is what I sound like with my rubber bands in. Not very good, I'd wager. Not terribly comprehensible. Somebody said when I said these things, it was quite humorous. But I'd like to see you talk with your rubber bands on. That's all I'm saying!
Happy Halloween! Thank you.